Welcome to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and foster care. Today, we're going to be talking about helping children heal from past trauma and loss with Carol Lozier. She is a licensed clinical social worker. She has spent 30 years counseling children, teens, and adults in issues of trauma, adoption, and foster care. She has published 4 books, including one of my very favorites, which is The Adoptive and Foster Parent Guide. Thank you so much, Carol, for joining us. This is a topic that I think you and I both feel a lot of passion around. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you. You're right. I do have a lot of passion. As you can tell, 30 years is a long time. That makes me feel really old.
Yeah. Well, I'm right there with you. Okay. So let's just say that a long time, but not 30 years. We'll just.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So I want to start by talking about, I think that people don't necessarily, let's be honest, trauma is a buzzword now. We hear everywhere. We hear trauma. Trauma-informed practice, trauma this, trauma that. But I think that sometimes we as parents don't really know what trauma is. I mean, yes, if a child has been bruised and beaten black and blue, that we associate with trauma, and clear that it is trauma. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about generally, how broad do we define trauma?
Well, they're basically, the way I think about it, the way I've learned over the years, is there's 2 types of trauma. Mm-hmm. So there's what we call big T trauma, just like the capital T. And that's the kind of trauma you just mentioned. Like, you know, if a child has been physically abused and there's bruises, mm-hmm. clearly that's trauma. And even people who might be skeptical of other kinds of traumas would say, yes, I agree, that's a trauma. Mm-hmm. So any kind of physical, sexual, emotional abuse that's easily seen or agreed upon by most people, that's definitely big T trauma. And then there's also like natural disasters. Unfortunately, like we hear a lot about school shootings. So, you know, those are the capital T traumas that everyone easily can note as such. Then we also have what we call the little T trauma. So little T trauma is, and this captures big T trauma as well. So things that feel overwhelming and upsetting to a child are the little T traumas, or big T. But the little T trauma, the difference here is these are smaller, upsetting, overwhelming events, situations that occur with repetition. So that could be bullying, you know, maybe a one-time event where a kid calls another kid a name or, you know, knocks them over. Like, is that upsetting? Yes. Is that trauma? Probably not. But when it happens every day, or it happens over and over and over, yes, that is trauma.
Well, I think most of our kids who have been at least adopted at an older age or have been in the foster care system have probably experienced what you're calling big T trauma. In addition, where do you fit neglect? Because I think that I certainly hear a lot of parents say, well, it was, you know, he wasn't abused, he was just neglected. So where does neglect fit within the Sure. big and little T's?
Well, neglect is something that occurs with repetition over time. And that's how it becomes neglect, is that, you know, the child wasn't cared for in some way, either emotionally, physically, medically. And so over time, that is a big T trauma. And neglect can be easily just as harmful as other kinds of abuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really can. And I think we discount it because it doesn't leave a visible bruise, but it certainly bruises a child's psyche, because children are so dependent upon the adults in their lives for care.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how does trauma, and we'll stick with that, the more big T type traumas, how does it impact children? And why are children more vulnerable?
Gosh, it impacts kids in so many ways. I mean, you know, it impairs their attachment first and foremost, which clearly they need in all areas throughout their life. They need to have secure, healthy attachments. So it impairs their attachment. It can impair their physical health. And that's where you'll see a lot of kids with sensory kinds of issues, coordination problems, medical issues. It impairs emotion regulation, where kids have a difficult time going from calm to upset and bringing themselves back down to calm. You know, a lot of the kids I work with, and a lot of the kiddos who've had any kind of neglect or trauma in their past, they start to get upset and then will get stuck in that emotion and they will have tantrums or meltdowns, whatever the family calls it, on the one end. But clearly on the other end of the spectrum, you can also have kids who shut down and who can't kind of get unstuck from that shutdown either. So they'll refuse to talk. They'll refuse to look at you. That's difficulty with emotion regulation too. And I think people forget that. They think meltdowns are what we call the problem with emotion regulation, but it can be either.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that makes good sense.
So the other thing that happens for kiddos who experience trauma is cognitive abilities. So you'll see kids, trauma will also affect speech and other things cognitively. I just wanted to add that.
Okay. So one of the issues, probably the most common question we get from parents is this behavior that they're seeing in their child normal developmental behavior or normal just because of that child's particular temperament? Or is this behavior based in trauma? I mean, because kids do differ. I mean, different age children will respond to a stimuli different ways, and different kids, just the way they are genetically made, will respond differently. So how can parents tell if the behavior they're seeing is trauma-based or just developmental?
So there's two different things that I kind of look for. And I'll be honest, like, even for me as a practitioner, and I do this every day, all day, there's times where I still need to look something up.
So, yeah, I bet.
Well, there's
that's
just,
true.
You know, yeah. Developmentally, there's so many changes. You know, kids change developmentally every 6 months. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to remember every single thing. But I love this series of books. They're by Louise Bates Ames.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The what's the title?
Well, there's one for each year.
Yeah.
So like this one that I'm looking at right now is called Your 9-Year-Old.
Yeah, Your 9-Year-Old, Your 8-Year-old, Your 7-Year-Old.
Exactly.
Right, exactly.
I love these. They're great. They go over every single thing you can think of developmentally that a kiddo is experiencing. But I would say the big thing I look for is, you know, with the behavior, is it age appropriate? First and foremost, because for example, it's super, super normal for a 2 or 3-year-old to have temper tantrums. Like, you know, like I can remember those days of carrying my kids out of the store, you know, screaming that they want it. And, you know, kids are just going to do that. That's part of the time where they learn emotion regulation. And at the same time, it's not in the realm of normalcy for a 5-year-old to have a long, drawn-out temper tantrum. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking for is what's normal development age-wise, and then the frequency of the behavior and the intensity. Like, let's say you're with your 5-year-old in the store and they really want the toy that you're saying, no, we can't have that. You know, they might whine for a little bit or kick their feet around a little bit and then move on. Okay, that's fine. But, you know, we're looking again at intensity and frequency. If the same child is screaming and throwing things for 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour, clearly that's outside the range.
All right. So frequency and intensity.
Yep.
And whether or not just developmentally it's spot
right.
on where the child should be. Well, you know, another thing that parents have to decide is, do we make a big deal? Do we actually address this issue, or do we just, some things we just need to let slide? So how do we know the distinction between those things that need to be addressed and those things that we can just, you know, sit, you know, put them on the back burner and know that
sure.
they likely will go away.
And Dawn, are you talking about things that we address as parent to child, or that we address by taking the child to therapy?
Well, probably both, but probably mainly taking to therapy. You know, what rises to the level of importance with our children that we need to do something about.
Mm-hmm. If a behavior or symptom interferes with the child's functioning in any way, at home, at school, in the community, that is something that we address.
Okay. Yeah.
And
so.
Yeah. And even to go a step further, I know I'm a therapist. I know, obviously, I believe in therapy. But one of the things that is so hard for me as a therapist is seeing a family that's waited and waited and waited. And it just breaks my heart, because here's the thing, like when your kiddo is around 8, even if you're thinking, you know, we've had little bumps in the road, there's really not what we would consider big issues that need to be addressed by therapy. Kiddo at 8 is welcoming to therapy, meaning they're more open to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be more inquisitive and interested and, you know, they're going to enjoy coming. I know that sounds weird, but they're going to enjoy coming.
No, actually,
you know, a lot of times at that age, we do coloring. I do stories with them. I do play stuff. I'm not heavy into play therapy, but with a child that age, you use play. And so I want the child to get to know what therapy is and to get to know me as a therapist for times in the future where they may need to come in. And it's a great time for a therapist to check out a kid and say, yeah, I think they're doing great. Or I think there's this one little thing. Let's work on that. Let's do a few sessions so it doesn't blossom into something else. So mm-hmm. that you address things early on, the child gets to know what therapy is and it's not scary or intimidating or means that they've got quote unquote problems or issues. It's just, it makes it natural and comfortable so that, you know, if the child, you know, goes when they're 8 or 9 for a few times and then doesn't go back until they're, you know, 12 or 13, you know, or even a little bit later, they're still going to be open to the mm-hmm. process. You know, when kiddos have come in and they're 15, 16, 17, they've never been to any therapy. At that point, they're naturally, you know, developmentally, they're beginning to become independent. And so they don't want to, for the most part, you know, mm-hmm. there's kids that do, but for the most part, they're not nearly as open to coming to therapy. And yes. it just makes it a lot harder for them and mm-hmm. for the therapist.
Right, right. It normalizes getting help, which is actually a good life lesson kind of across the board.
Yeah, it's a great life lesson. Because, you know, life is not a straight shot. It's a series of ups and downs.
Yeah, amen.
Amen, right?
Amen. This show is brought to you by our underwriter, the Jockey Being Family Foundation. Jockey Being Family has a national backpack program that provides newly adopted kiddos with a backpack, which is personalized with their initials. And each backpack includes an adorable little bear and a blanket. But, and from my perspective as a parent educator, I will say one of the things that's most important is that it also includes a parent tote. And the tote bag is full of resources for parents that helps them navigate the adoptive parent journey. If you're a parent, please ask your agency to join up and be a part of the backpack program. And if you're an agency, then do it yourself. It's easy to do. Go to their website, jockeybeingfamily.com, and click on the word backpack. It is free to agencies and it is free to families. So get on over there and grab that backpack now. Another question we often get is about triangulation. It's probably one of the most frustrating things that parents face, especially, and I think that adoptive and foster children are more prone to that. So let's talk a little about triangulation. Mm-hmm. What is it, first of all? It's a fancy word, but it's I guarantee it's something that most of us have experienced.
Oh my goodness, yes. And it's really frustrating for people who are in it. So triangulation is the idea of a triangle and a triangle in relationships. And oftentimes that's basically two sides or two corners of the triangle. So it's two people or a person in a community or a school or other entity against another. So oftentimes what I see is it's typically one parent and the child, and they're in collaboration against the other parent.
Give us an example. The example using a parent. Give us an example.
Okay. So, for example, the one that I see the most frequently is there is a child that is upset with maybe their mom. Because as you know, in adoption, the majority of the time when kiddos are upset with the parent, it's typically the mom, which I feel like goes back to the abandonment that they incur from bio mom.
Mm-hmm.
So typically what happens is that kiddo will complain about mom or mom's decisions with dad, and dad will be in agreement with the child. And then say to mom, hey, why are you being so hard on our kid? You know, you don't understand where they're coming from. You're just, you know, your consequences are too hard on them. You're just not being understanding and nurturing like I thought you would be. You're just, Yeah. You're just too hard on them. And the mom, oftentimes what happens in the background is the kiddo is doing things that the dad doesn't see. You know, they kind of save it for mom, unfortunately. And so mom is struggling on her own, typically, to work the best they can with the child and try to help the child heal from the things that they've experienced in life. And unfortunately, when this triangulation happens, mom and dad are on a separate page.
Mm-hmm.
And the triangulation continues. It makes it really hard for mom and dad to work together, which is really what the child needs. The child mm-hmm. needs for mom and dad to be a team in order to help the child heal from whatever they've experienced, that trauma, or that loss or abandonment from their past. And, you know, the child isn't doing it to be hateful or mean. The child is doing it out of survival.
It has worked for them in the past.
It has worked very well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they're just in a place of fear and acting on that fear.
I think it's so important for parents to realize that sometimes the behaviors, they may be unproductive behaviors, they may drive us crazy, but very often the behaviors we're seeing because it has been effective for this child, and maybe effective enough that it was life-saving or emotion-saving for them. So, yeah.
Completely.
How often do you see that situations where a child prefers one parent over another? Is that fairly common?
I would say, I mean, I can't think of a percentage off the top of my head, but it's fairly common.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. You know, you have to remember it's brought up more when it becomes more intense. I may not hear about it in a more mild case,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And I think all families, regardless, will, you know, that we called it opinion shopping, you know, where the child will didn't get the answer they wanted from one parent. So,
sure.
They, you know, that's a fairly typical.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's just, you know, kids being kids.
Yeah.
This is different, and it's a whole different level. Of, you know, and I know typically the person who's being ousted from the triangle feels like the child's being incredibly manipulative. And, mm-hmm. you know, that word has such a negative connotation to it, but really that manipulative stance really goes back to what I was saying before, that it's out of fear and survival.
All right. So let's talk a little about we've talked about a triangle, and that gives us a good visual image. So mm-hmm. there are three corners to a triangle. I mm-hmm. vaguely remember from my geometry. So what are the typical roles or corners? It's often called, what are the corners of the triangle? But what I think it really means, or what are some of the typical roles that when we're caught up in triangulation, we might be playing, or we may be able to recognize the other, or our child and our spouse or our partner might be playing.
Sure. Typically, the kiddo is in that rebel place. So that's the child separating the parents and creating that triangulation. So it's oftentimes where they will pit one parent against the other. And typically, the mom is the person who's in that warrior kind of role. So lots of concern about how this is ever going to get back on an even keel, how the child's going to heal if they're in the triangulation, and also how in the world is she going to get dads to see that mm-hmm. this triangulation is happening, because so many times the dads don't see it. And then finally, the dad is in that fixer role oftentimes. So these aren't, you know, these roles can be fluid. People can change around. So it's not like this is a role that they're stuck in, but this is kind of typically how mm-hmm. it looks.
So and we've got the three corners. Let me see if I can do that. Yep. Let's see, the three corners. We have the fixer, then we have the warrior, and then we have the rebel. And
yes.
So and the parent who is on the out of the trio
yep.
Tends to take the role of the warrior.
Right.
And the child typically will take the role of the rebel, and the
right.
parent who is in cahoots, or is in the
right.
In conjunction with the child, tends to be the one who wants to come in and rescue and fix and do whatever.
Exactly. Okay. And you know it's hard because everyone has good intention here, but we still need to name it and say it's going on to be able for it to really be, you know, something that can become part of the child's healing. As long as that triangulation is going on, everybody's sort of stuck.
So what are some ways to break the triangle? Now you're stuck in a triangle. Now you've recognized it. So what are some ways to break it?
Well, I think first is to recognize that it's happening. And so each person needs to look at what's my typical role in the triangulation? How do I notice that that is coming up? What kinds of feelings do I have when that triangulation occurs? For example, the dad might be in that fixer role and might say, wow, I really feel like I need to save my kid, or I really feel like I need to, you know, tell my wife that she's doing something that's not helpful. So recognizing the thoughts and feelings that go along with the role, and then naming it and saying, hey, I can tell that I'm having an urge to tell you that you're not doing this right and you're being too hard on our kid. And so when everybody can name it and say that, yes, this is happening, then they're able to say, okay, let's take a break here. Let's take some deep breaths and really look at how can the parents be a team and working together? How can they compromise on whatever might be going on and really be able to talk through the situation as opposed to kind of being pitted one against the other? Really, mm-hmm. we want the mom and dad to be the team and the child to be under them, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want the dad and the child or the mom and the child being a unit as a team against the other parent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So recognizing it. And then also, it seems like from what I heard you saying, also recognize what you may be getting out of your role.
Definitely.
Because sometimes we choose a role because it's meeting a need we have.
Sure.
And the thing is, the child's not going to probably break this. It's going to be up to the two parents.
Definitely.
And just before we move off of triangulation, it's not always with the parents. Give some other examples.
Sure.
Where it might not be the parent.
Well, you know, the child might come home from school and say to the mom, my teacher is so mean to me. My teacher, my principal, the counselor at school, whomever,
they're picking on me.
They're terrible to me, when maybe that's not actually how it happened. And again, it's, you know, oftentimes maybe it's, you know, the child's in that place of feeling scared that, you know, felt scared that the teacher did get upset with them. And at the same time, that doesn't mean that, you know, that the teacher was mean and rude and hateful and hates my guts and, you know, wants me out of the classroom. Mm-hmm. So I think it's super important when we feel like we need to jump into that fix-it role or that worry role, whichever role it is, that we take a deep breath and take a step back and really look at, okay, what else could be going on? What might I be missing? And, you know, calmly go in to talk to the teacher or the principal or the school counselor or whomever to find out exactly everyone's point of view. And, you know, that's not to say sometimes our kids don't get picked on. And then, you know, your mama bear can come out. Great, no problem. Mm-hmm. Let's make sure it's not a triangulation first.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. Thank you. This show could not and would not happen without the generous support of our partners who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, accurate information to pre- and post-adoptive families, as well as to pre- and post-foster families. A couple of our wonderful partners include Children's House International. They have a reputation for working in the best interest of children and supporting adoptive families while providing ethical adoption services. They've been uniting families for over 40 years and have found homes for over 3,000 children. We also have Hopscotch Adoption. They are a Hague-accredited international adoption agency placing children from Armenia, Bulgaria, Croatia, Georgia, Ghana, Guyana, Morocco, Pakistan, Serbia, Ukraine, and they also do kinship adoptions. And we thank both of them for their support of Creating a Family. All right, as our children age, they have a number of different identities. Clearly, they have the identity of our family, of the adoptive or the foster family, because that's mm-hmm. where they are now. But they also haven't been with us forever, especially if they've been adopted at an older age. So they also have the identity of, and even if they have been adopted at birth, they still have the genetic identity and other cultural identities, racial identity of their birth family. And then, especially as they age into adolescence, they're beginning to form their own identity based on who they are. Mm-hmm. So it seems like for one of our roles in helping children heal and helping them grow into being the people that they need to be and are meant to be, is to help them integrate all of their different identities. But they have a lot of different identities. So can you give some suggestions on what we can do as adoptive parents to help our children integrate their different selves?
One of the things I like to do with kiddos and those preteens is to really talk about those different parts of them and how all those parts come together to make the wonderful, wonderfully made kiddo that they are. And so one of the exercises I'll even do with kids is I'll take a piece of paper and kind of divide it into three columns. And then at the top of each column, I'll write birth family, forever family, and then me. And what we do is we kind of go through what do they feel like. And also if the parents are in the room, parents can chime in, but you know, what do they feel like are the things, the gifts, the talents, the physical traits or attributes that they've gotten from their birth family, the things they've gotten from their forever family, and also the things that are just them. And it's a really neat exercise to do with kids because, you know, it's on paper, they're writing it down, it's visual, they can see it, we're talking about it, they hear it. And I think it's really neat for them to be able to see, wow, I'm really kind of, you know, I'm made from all these great mm-hmm. parts of me are coming together. So that's one way I like to do it. And then another way is to help them, because I like to do things that are visual, not just the auditory explanation. I think it's super important to incorporate all forms of learning for kids because kids learn in all different ways. And so another thing is to take different colors of yarn or maybe the floss. And so maybe they would choose orange to represent birth mom and light blue to represent birth dad and different colors for adoptive mom and dad and them and braid it all together. Then that would be a bracelet that they would wear to remind them of just all these amazing parts of them that they have that come from all these great people that they've had in their lives. And I know sometimes, which I understand, you know, I know one concern that maybe adoptive families would have would be, oh, and they can also include foster families that have been important mm-hmm. to them as well. But I know sometimes, you know, adoptive families are concerned about, well, you know, my kiddo had a really tough birth family and, you know, I don't, you know, I'm not in favor of a lot of the things the birth family did. And mm-hmm. I understand that. And at the same time, we can still find maybe, you know, their eye color is just beautiful. And that came from birth mom. Like, let's look for the gifts and the attributes and the positive qualities that arose from, you know, the people who gave birth to them.
Yeah, I do think that foster and adoptive families, it's especially if it has been the children have had a very rough beginning, they don't want their children to identify with the birth family. But the reality is our kids are going to identify one way or the other. Yep. And recognizing that and finding the positives that they yep. can identify, which is not to say that you ignore some of the negatives, right. but recognizing that each of the families that have been in their lives have brought something that's helping this child become, yep. as you said, the wonderful person that they are.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. I want to talk now about some practical tips. Let's be honest, as parents, oftentimes, what we really need to know are some really good tips of what to do mm-hmm. in the heat of the moment to help our children heal and from past loss and trauma, but also to help them behave in a way that is acceptable and teaching them. And the essence of discipline is education. So in many mm-hmm. ways, what we're trying to do is educate our children to behave in a way that doesn't make them the subject of teachers' disdain or other adults or other children's disdain. So mm-hmm. let's talk about, first of all, let me back up and say, one question we will often get is, how do I help my child heal? And when I don't know what happened, because sometimes our children aren't able to tell us it happened before they were pre-verbal, or their children don't remember, or don't remember it on a conscious level, or for whatever reason are not able to tell us. And that's not uncommon in either fostering situations or when adopting older children, regardless if we are adopting them from the foster care system or internationally. Mm-hmm. So how do we help them heal when we have no clue what really happened?
Right. Well, you know, before age three, people don't have autobiographical memory. And so they're not able to close their eyes and picture that memory in their head. They don't see a picture in their head of what happened. And so they're not going to feel like they remember, but they have different kinds of memory that do hold what occurred. And so they have emotion memory. They have body memory. And so they truly do remember the things that happened. And, you know, a parent will note this if you can look at a child's behavior and recognize that that had to come from something that occurred to them. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, let's say in your home, so you adopted a kiddo at age 2.5, right, from an orphanage. And maybe in that orphanage they had, you know, they had food at every meal, but it was the exact same meal all throughout the day, every day. So your child comes home at 2.5 and you notice right away or soon after that they get very upset if they don't have food, if they don't have food on the, you know, that they can see on the table. And so clearly they don't maybe have that visual memory at that point, but their behavior shows that there wasn't adequate food for them. And that's that body memory or the feeling memory that's coming up for them. Okay. So the way that we work on healing is through recreating the past trauma, but with a new and more healing kind of ending to it. So what you can do is, a lot of times in therapy, I'll do this in pictures. So I'll ask the kiddo to draw a picture for me about when you lived in the orphanage, there wasn't enough food for all the kids. And so what do you think that looked like? And this is obviously a kid who's older that can draw. If it's a child who's younger, you would use little, like for example, little play people. So what we'll do is we will have the child draw or state how in the drawing, how they were feeling. Like we would ask them to draw a picture of what it was like for them to not have enough food in the orphanage. And then we would imagine, you know, saying, hey, let's imagine that we're there with the child, you know, with this little two-year-old, you know, what's it like for them being at the orphanage and not having enough food? And so we really kind of go through a recreation of what would the child need to feel better in that situation, to feel less scared or less sad or less angry that there wasn't food. And so a lot of times kids will say, well, I wanted a buffet at the orphanage. And I'll say, great, draw that buffet in there for that little two-year-old. And they will draw every single food that they wanted to have, that they feel like that they wanted to have at that age. And so creating for them in a way what wasn't there in the moment.
Okay. And that would be the recreation of through in a safe environment through play acting with stuffed animals or dolls or drawing, depending on the skill level and the age of the child.
Right. And with older kids, we don't use drawing. I don't use drawing or play. We just talk through it. But with all that, you know, it's part of what I do in EMDR therapy. Okay. And EMDR therapy is a way to work on past trauma. So that stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
And that's a therapeutic method that is effective for children who have experienced trauma.
Correct.
All right. So let's talk about some other things that parents can do. One, talk about the child's experience, play act it, recreate it with a different outcome, an outcome that the child has some control over. All right. So what are some other tips and practical tips from a parenting standpoint that parents can implement? And let's start by talking, because I think this is so often, I'm speaking for myself here, so often where I need to focus is I got to start with me.
Yeah.
Because generally, if you know, if my kid is really misbehaving, I'm irritated at this point.
Sure.
Maybe even past the irritation point. And so let's start with things that parents can, mantras or whatever that they can use to address themselves before, and then we'll talk about actual techniques they can use with their child.
Okay. I mean, I think first and foremost for any parent, easy said, easy for me to say, but we have to stay in a place of calm.
Yeah.
Because like you've already mentioned, you know, our children know us. And when we begin to get frustrated, irritated, annoyed, they know right away and their brain begins to match ours. And so the more frustrated and agitated we get, their brain will follow and they will match, if not surpass, our level of frustration or irritation. And so, you know, a parent needs to notice their early warning signs. So what are my early warning signs that I'm starting to get frustrated or agitated? They need to stop and take those deep breaths and really slow themselves down. Slow their body down, slow their movement down, really concentrate on softening their face and their voice. And, you know, really, really recognizing I need to be in a place where I'm calm and caring for myself and for my child.
Okay, so that's the first step is to get into your head and recognize that you've got to be in control here if it's going to be effective.
Exactly.
All right. So what can we do with our children? One of the things that you've talked about is finding just right. What do you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Well, finding just right is one way to help kiddos calm their body. And this, of course, is before a child gets too agitated. There's other things you can do when a child gets more agitated. But in the beginning, you want to make sure that your kiddo's body is in a calm place for them to stay calm, because your body and your emotions kind of follow each other. And so I talk to kiddos about, I use three different squares right next to each other, and I color them in. So the green square is in the middle, the blue square is to the left, and the red square is to the right. And a lot of times I'll talk to them using that Goldilocks story about the porridge being too hot, too cold, and just right. Mm-hmm. And so when their body is moving too fast, that's in the red, too hot, too fast. When their body, and that's oftentimes when you see agitation on a kiddo. Remember, I talked about kids also will be on the opposite end of the spectrum and shutting down. And that's that blue too slow. So maybe they're not looking at you, they're not talking, they refuse to answer. And really, we want our kiddos to be just right in the middle, where they're calm, they're able to answer, they're not yelling, they're just right.
Mm-hmm. A lot of times, I think our children don't really recognize the emotions they're feeling. So how, and that is an impact of trauma.
Yeah.
So how can we help them recognize and identify? And is that helpful ultimately in letting them gain control over some of their emotions?
Oh, completely. So, you know, just kind of sticking with what I just mentioned, another way that I'll work with those three different colors and those three squares is, you know, what's an animal that moves too fast? A lot of times kids will say like a lion or a tiger. Too slow would be turtle, and just right might be a dog. A lot of kids like to say dog or kitty cat. And so, you know, you can practice with them. Okay, show me the tiger. How's the tiger move? And then you say, okay, now show me the turtle. Now show me the dog. And so we're helping kids learn how to adjust their body given where they are, because we want them to stay in just right when we're in the home. Now, when we're outside on the playground, they can be like that tiger and to be moving fast. And we're in the library, we want them to be turtle. So it really depends on where they are as to how we want their body moving, which in turn affects their emotion. And so you can play a little game with them and try to, you know, get them to move in different ways according to where you are.
Okay. Another issue that our children often face is negative self-beliefs. They don't often, they've very often not had much positive said about them, and their behavior doesn't lend itself to people saying nice things about them. Mm-hmm. And they come to us with beliefs about themselves that have been formed through interactions with their birth family, interactions with adults who are responding to their poor behavior. Mm-hmm. So how do we address the negative self-beliefs our kids may come to us with?
Right. Well, I think first is you want to help them verbalize that. So in times where you think possibly that your child is having a negative belief about themselves, you want to ask them, mm-hmm. I see that you're sad. I know such and such happened at school today. The teacher yelled at you. What does that make you think about yourself? You know, we're looking for what's the answer they're giving. I'm always amazed at how honest and forthright kids can be if you ask the question. A lot of times people don't ask, but you know, when you ask them that, they might say, well, I think the teacher thinks I'm a bad kid because I think I'm a bad kid. Or they may say, well, the teacher yelled at me and that made me feel upset, but I understand it was just, I was yelling in the classroom and we're not supposed to. So you want to look for how does your child answer the question? So if you are able to spot that negative self-belief, clearly you want to talk with your kiddo about that and say, that's not true about you. You know, yes, some things have happened and in the past you made some decisions that weren't wise, but that's not who you are as a person. I know you're a great kid. And so you have to look for as a parent how your child is responding to that. Mm-hmm. If your child is responding to that and healing, then that's great. That's what you want to keep doing. If you are giving that child that, you know, feedback and they're not healing as you're giving the feedback, then that would be a time to look into therapy.
Okay. And the last thing I want to talk about is something that I think that it's gotten a bad rap, and that is behavior charts.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of parents, and quite frankly, a lot of professionals will say mm-hmm. that they're simply not effective. And yet I think when done well, they can be effective, even for children who have experienced trauma. And we know they can be effective for children who haven't. But
yes,
but I'm talking about kids who have. And they're an effective healing tool as well, not just to get your child to behave a certain way, but I think they can be effective in the healing modality. So let's talk about, first of all, what is your opinion on behavior charts?
And I love then, behavior charts.
Okay, good. I thought I kind of knew that because of the book. That was a setup because I'd actually have read the book, and I agree. So let's talk about how to do them well and how to do them with children who have experienced trauma. And we want to do them in a way that helps heal. So, all of that's a setup. So how do we do that?
Okay, so I think first and foremost, parents want to start with what is one or two, at the very most three, and when you're starting out, I wouldn't do more than two behaviors that you want to work on. And we want it to be very specific behaviors.
Now give us an example.
Okay, so on a behavior chart, and let me just add, we want the statement of what we're looking for to be said in the positive. So we would not say, you know, don't yell.
Yeah. Or stop being a brat.
Yes. We would not say those things. So we want to tell the child what we're looking for so they know what to do.
Okay.
For example, we also wouldn't say, I want, you know, number one wouldn't be something global like behave out when we're out in public or listen, you know, just a real general, mm-hmm. you know, listen when we go to church. Mm-hmm. Those are way too global. We need it to be something very specific. So you might say something like, I'm trying to think of a specific behavior here that we could work on. So for example,
when mom says no, that you cannot have a toy at the grocery store.
Okay.
So we're going to say it positive. You will be disappointed, but you will, not throw a tantrum. That's saying negative. Okay. You put it in the positive, but
okay.
Yeah.
So that would be, I will accept mom's no.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, and you can add to that if you want. You could say, I will accept mom's no by saying, okay. what you would do is you would have, like I said, no more than three of those goals. And then what we want to come up with is, in the very beginning, the first week, we want to make the child successful. If a child isn't going to start out successful, they're going to lose interest very quickly. So if you feel like your child could manage that two times this week, then you're going to start with two, right? Two times this week, I want to fill in the box of my child accepting no and saying, okay, I will accept your no of not getting the toy. So start out small and know that next week you're going to go up to three times that week of accepting no. And the other thing is, so we want to change that up every week. The other thing is, every week you have to come up with something that the child wants to earn at the end of the chart. If the child really isn't interested in earning ice cream, then that's not going to be a good goal for the child, to a good thing that they want to earn at the end of their chart. Mm-hmm. And the other thing you have to think about is, like, let's say Sundays after dinner, you go get the ice cream, you get the reward the child has earned. Well, if the child has eaten a lot of dinner that night, they eaten a whole bunch, ice cream's not going to be a big reward either. So mm-hmm. you want to time things well. You want to make sure that it's maybe an hour after lunch or an hour after dinner is when you go get the treat.
Mm-hmm.
So charts need to be changed frequently to maintain the child's interest. If the goals aren't changed, and if the amount of times they have to earn the goals aren't changed, and then the reward isn't changed, they will lose their interest quickly. But if you can change that up, that you can keep the charts going, and it can be a great way to work on behavior.
And I would also say, depending on the age and the chronological age, but also the developmental age of the child, yeah. a week may be way too long. You may be
absolutely.
It may be half a day. It may be between now and lunch.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. And the other thing that I have found effective for just some children, and most will not need this, but for some children, if the reward is, let's say, something tangible, like a matchbox car, to actually tape the matchbox car onto the reward chart so that the child actually sees it. And again, a lot of kids won't need that. They're going to have the ability to imagine and hold in their head. But for some kids, oftentimes the ones that you're having to say, we're only going to go half a day. Because the idea is that we want them to experience success.
Definitely.
And some kids, you know, a week is just going to be way too long.
Oh, definitely. Right. So it does. It depends on the child's age. You can shorten it to, usually when I do a morning and then an afternoon are different points that they earn or different squares that they earn. So that's one way to also do it. Or you can shorten it to like 2 or 3 days and then you earn a reward. Absolutely. Yeah. And try to keep in mind too, rewards aren't something that we spend a lot of money on, right? You want to try to make rewards things like relationship builders and small things like ice cream cone or things like little arts things from the fabric store or, you know, the dollar store. Yeah. So, or relationship, like, you know, getting to play a game with mom or dad or someone in the family that they normally don't get to do.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah. So consider using behavior charts and play around with them with your child to find out what's effective and what works. Well, thank you so much, Carol Lozier, for being with us today to talk about how to help our children heal from trauma and past loss. If you have enjoyed the information in this podcast, do us a favor and please recommend it to a friend. Most people find out about podcasts from their friends, so be a friend and recommend ours. Also, the views expressed in this show are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family, our partners, or our underwriters. And keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, you need to talk with your adoption or foster care professional. So, Carol, if people want to reach out and get more information about you, they can certainly buy the book, or you've got a number of books, but the one in specific, the Adoptive and Foster Parent Guide, they can do that off of any independent bookseller or Amazon or any type of online seller. Where can they get more information about you?
Yeah, because I have a lot of great free resources on my website. So my website is carollozierlcsw.com. It's super easy.
carollozierlcsw.com.
Yep.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Carol. I appreciate it.